Hello, good morning, it's Sunday morning, it's Abbey 104, and it's time for Folk Tales. And in the studio today, I have David Shepherd, who is a current presenter on BBC South West. Good morning, David.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, no, thank you very much for coming. It's a great pleasure to welcome you. And your current programmes extend all across the South West, don't they?
Yes, you can even, and I don't want to poach any listeners here because you have some fine offerings late at night on Abbey 104, particularly that bloke
Friday
on
evening.
Fridays. Yes, but yes, you can even get me if you stand somewhere near the very top of the Abbey itself.
And is that right?
Stick a coat hanger out into the breeze, and occasionally I drift across into Sherborne.
Oh, that's wonderful. So it's BBC South West, and that incorporates Devon and Cornwall, and what else?
Well, I also belong to the Channel Islands, mm-hmm. Although they probably don't want me. I drift across towards the Channel Islands as well. It's basically everything west of Bristol has to suffer me late at night.
I see. And this is 10 till 1, isn't it?
10 till 1.
Every weekday.
And we almost make it to 1 o'clock some nights without drifting off. We have a little competition between the audience and myself to see who can stay up the latest. And usually they've gone by about half past 10.
I'm sure your figures tell a different story to that, but welcome to Abbey 104 anyway. I hope the surroundings here are not, well, I don't suppose they're quite as palatial as BBC in Plymouth.
Well, I don't know. At least you can be assured that everything here works. there are lots of reassuring lights and buttons, and all the bulbs seem to work. I've just been round and unscrewed most of the bulbs.
Thank you. That will make life very much easier later in the day. Thank you. I looked on your profile on the BBC website, and it's not very complimentary. It says David Shepherd is as tall as he is thin.
Oh, but it's true. It may not be complimentary, but it's definitely true. When I went to secondary school, I would have been, well, I suppose we were all 11 or 12, weren't we? And I was 167 centimetres tall. I was an early developer.
Right.
I was 167 centimetres tall, which for the kids out there is about 5'3". And by the time I left the sixth form, I'd grown 5 millimetres in height, but quite significantly in girth. And so I am just roughly a sort of round ball now.
Right, OK. Well, that's not quite what I'm seeing across the desk here, but OK, we'll leave that to one side. But there's one other thing on there which is intriguing before we sort of get into the nitty-gritty about how you came to be a BBC presenter. It says you have a halibut memory for numbers, and despite very extensive research, I've no idea what that means.
Well, I've got a very good memory for all numbers that I don't need to remember.
OK.
So, for example, the Abbey 104 phone number escapes me, and yet it's one that I should know. My own telephone number, no hope at all.
Okay.
Yours, Terry, I could probably remember the last three digits of anybody's phone number, but not the actual useful bit of it that would get me through to them.
Yeah.
But anything else, number plates, I could name every number plate of every car that either I have owned or members of my family or friends, even primary school friends. E268 ERX was my best friend's white Volvo in 1984.
That's very useful information, isn't
it? And there it is. It's in there. It's all in there.
Okay, so the halibut bit refers to the fact that it's not particularly useful anymore.
And extensive as well. I mean, I can remember long runs of numbers. Right. And I was once tested on a number up to 30 for children in need. And I got there. But for me, it was easy. Somebody gave me a 30-digit number to remember, and just because of the way my mind worked, it was very, very simple to remember this. But you have to make these things look hard for anybody to appreciate them.
Absolutely.
So I stumbled and ummed and ahed, and was it a 6 or was it a 9? I couldn't remember. Let's turn the page up the other way. Oh, yes, yes. And we got there to a run of 30. So big sequences of numbers, for some reason, they stay in there.
OK, all right. Well, I tell you what, we're going to come back and talk a little bit about your life and, as I say, how you became part of BBC, but let's have your first track, which is Del Shannon, Everybody Loves a Clown. How come?
Well, this was my favourite song when I was a child.
Yeah.
And not because it was around at all, really, when I was younger. The song was already 25 years old at that point, and it was never really a great hit. But nonetheless, it was a song that was always on in my dad's car.
Oh, right.
And he really introduced me to what has become a bit of an obsession with the 60s and things that were before my time. And the great Del Shannon, of course. This is a wonderful song.
OK, let's have a listen, shall we? Well, that's Del Shannon and Everybody Loves the Clown, and originally a Gary Lewis and the Playboys track from their 1965 album of the same name. And in the studio today, I've got David Shepherd, who's a real live broadcaster from the BBC. And we've just, we're going to explore a little bit about your early life, David, if we may. Born whereabouts?
I was born in Reading, I'm afraid,
okay. Yeah.
Which is why I love the West Country so much, because right. It was always an escape and a different world, really, to the one that I grew up in. And Reading is much derided, but a fine place nonetheless. And the good thing about Reading, really, is that you can be anywhere in about 3 hours, because it suffers with congestion.
Yeah,
so
well,
you have to spend 3 hours before you actually leave Reading itself.
Yes, the bit between Reading Town Centre and the motorway.
That's right.
It takes quite a while, doesn't it? But large family, or you one of how many?
One of three,
okay.
And I was the third of three.
Right.
And we grew up just outside Reading in a place called Twyford.
Okay.
And I went to a comp school, good old comp school boy, and this was a comp school near Wargrave. And if you know the area, Wargrave is quite a plush part of Berkshire, just not far from Henley-on-Thames. And so often we would talk about, well, I went to school in Wargrave, but actually this was a very average comp school, and I loved it. There's such a mix of people there. And I think that's one of the wonderful things about comprehensive schools. You get just such a range of different abilities, characters from all walks of life. And I loved it. I was like the king of the school there, because I excelled at a lot of different subjects. And I really liked the variety of stuff that we were studying. And I threw myself into every opportunity. I did the music. I did the choir. I was in the orchestra. I couldn't play an instrument, but I was in the orchestra nonetheless. Drama. I threw myself into all the theatre productions we did. I was a careers librarian. And I didn't want to leave. I just enjoyed school so much. And still have school dreams to this day. I'm sure people listening have this, where they wake up in the night and they had a dream that they're bound for an exam at school for which they haven't prepared. Well, I get those to this day, and I think it just harks back to a particularly good and satisfying bit.
So it was a really good school experience, as you've said. This, just to put it in context, would have been the early to mid 90s then, would it? Without giving your age away too much, David.
93 to 2000. So okay. I stayed on into the sixth form there.
Right. So what were your, you say you really enjoyed it. Did you have any flair for anything in particular at that stage?
Well, this was the difficulty. As I went on, I made it my mission to be good at everything. I'm one of life's great perfectionists. I strive for perfection. And when I fail, as inevitably I do, as we all do from time to time, I take it very badly. And that then sets you up to do better next time. And I got into the maths and the sciences fairly easily. And I worked at the English and really enjoyed that. But I ended up in a situation where I was enjoying school so much and enjoying being king of the school and getting involved in all these things, that I didn't really want to think about what came next, and I didn't want to go. And so while a lot of my contemporaries were thinking, I'd like to be a doctor, I'd like to be an engineer, I'd like to be whatever, I had no idea. I had no idea what the next step would be, because ticking over in the back of my mind was the thought that I really, really liked the idea of becoming Terry Wogan.
Ah, right.
And yet I had no idea how I might make that happen. It was no more realistic for me that I might end up on the radio.
It's a limited career path.
Yes, it would be, although he did pretty well at it.
Yeah, he did. It's true, yes.
But it, for me, the possibility of growing up and being on the radio was no more realistic than growing up and being a spaceman.
Because just to reflect, your family doesn't have a media background at all, does it?
No. My dad is an engineer by trade, pretty much self-taught. He started as an apprentice at an Austin dealership, working on their vans, and then he moved to the engineering side of a well-known, and you can tell I'm a BBC man, a well-known department store with allied supermarket chain, both of which have stripes in their logo.
Ah, okay.
And he was then responsible for running the distribution side of that, so the lorries and the servicing of them, and also the designing of them. Here's a little fact for you. This is a takeout fact for when it goes quiet in the pub on Friday. My dad is widely credited as having designed the country's first double-deck lorry.
Ah, right.
So there it is.
Right.
There it is.
Okay, well, we'll maybe come back to that one. So you really left school then without any real idea of what you wanted to do. So what happened next? You went to university, didn't you?
I did. And it sounds glib to say, but I accidentally happened to go to Oxford.
Okay.
Which was an extraordinary thing looking back on.
Fairly local to Reading, I suppose.
Yes, and that was one of the things that appealed, because I didn't want to grow up and I didn't really want to leave home and I didn't really want to leave school. Being quite so close to home was one of those things that appealed.
Yeah.
But also because I pushed myself hard to do well in exams, it was felt at the school that it would be a good thing for me to apply.
So how on earth did you decide what course to take then?
Well, I decided that really, if I was going to pursue radio, I needed something to fall back on that was solid and recognised for when radio went wrong.
Okay.
Because radio, I was aware even then, is much like being an actor, where you can be in and out of work, in and out of favour, and you can lose your career very, very easily just by saying the wrong thing.
Yeah.
Or falling out of vogue for whatever reason. And so I decided that I would look close to home at how other people had made their careers work, and decided that I would study engineering, economics and management.
Okay.
So life could have been very different, Terry. It could have been very different
it
indeed.
Could, couldn't it? Yes.
And I applied for this without really realising that Oxford was quite such a competitive environment as it was. And I went for an interview, which was a terrible experience in many ways, in that it was hugely nerve-wracking. The surroundings in Oxford are wonderful but intimidating to a newcomer. And I made a real mess of this interview, and the college said, well, I don't think we want him, but actually, academically, he seems to be quite good, so we'll pass him on to the college next door and they might want him.
Oh,
and indeed they did. I went for an interview there. It was much better, and in I got, and found myself at Oxford. And I was the first person from my school to go there.
Right.
And they, of course, were enormously proud. And gradually, I'm very slow to realise whenever I've achieved something. It's usually once it's happened and gone. But gradually, I started to realise that I'd done okay, and this was a good thing, and that I needed to try and make it work if I could.
Okay, so you went to Oxford, and but you didn't stay there too long.
No, I found that the course was wrong.
Okay, so this was the engineering and management and economics.
Yeah, the first year was in an all-round grounding in engineering, but I found that we were just working on maths puzzles so much.
All right.
I couldn't quite make the leap into where that fitted into a career in engineering, where I wanted to build bridges or design an engine or make a suspension system for a Morris Minor, which I did while I was there. Actually, I built one.
Oh, you did? Oh, okay. Well, that's,
And so I decided that really I did have a choice. I could either stay and try and make it work, or I could cut and run. And by this point, I felt a little bit more confident about radio. I'd made some friends at the BBC. I'd been writing to Terry Wogan as a contributor for a few years.
Ah, yes. Now, but tell us briefly about that, because you became quite a regular contributor on his show, didn't you?
Yes, daily at one point.
And you weren't employed by the BBC at this point?
No. I did this from about 16. It was just at the time that fax machines became prolific.
Right.
And if you can imagine, and many people wouldn't be able to now, because we've got so much communication at our fingertips, but the excitement of being able to jump out of bed, send a fax to Terry Wogan and have it read.
And what did these faxes say?
Well, I started off doing the kind of musing that show encouraged.
He was the world's best at poking fun at himself, wasn't he?
The master of self-deprecation and seeing the funny side of situations. So I started off doing those, and then eventually I developed this character who was the assistant to the BBC's director general, and he would write to them daily. Wogan and his producer, Paul Walters, who I'll talk a bit more about later, and they would always be fired. So they'd be fired by my character daily for something that had happened on the show or something that was alleged to have happened after the show or when they've gone to a party or something's been happening.
So presumably if you were sending these in regularly, eventually they got in contact with you, did they, and came to know you as an individual rather than just some obscure figure that keeps emailing them?
Well, when I went off to university, one of my school friends who'd heard these letters, and of course nobody at school wanted to admit to listening to Terry Wogan.
Of course not.
But they'd all say, well, I was in my mum's car and Terry Wogan was on. I listened to Radio 1. I don't listen to that. But we heard your name. Is it you? Yes, it is me. And I'd explain.
Yeah.
One of my friends from school, when I went off to university, knowing that I was having quite a hard time of it, said they wrote to the radio station and said, could he come in for a look round and to meet you all? Mm. And they knew the letters, and I went in, and Alan Dedicote, who's since become a great friend, showed me around, and we met Wogan, and Wogan thanked me for the letters, which remains one of my proudest moments, to be thanked by somebody who is obviously so successful at what they do and such a nice man. And from that point, I started to make a few contacts. And so I found myself in a situation at Oxford where I wasn't enjoying things necessarily. They weren't going too well. And I did then have a bit more confidence about saying, radio is what I want to do.
You might just be able to make a career out of this.
I think I can work it.
Okay, look, we're going to play your second track and then we'll sort of move on from there as to how you came to be more involved in radio in a bigger way. But the second track is what?
This is a Fleetwood Mac song, which Wogan used to play as his second song very often. So okay. I thought it would do for mine.
All right, it's Fleetwood Mac and Say You Love Me. That's Fleetwood Mac, Say You Love Me, from 1975, the title track from their album of the same name. Well, I suppose it would be the same name of the album if it's the title track, wouldn't it? But it sold over 8 million copies, so a very successful album that was too. And in the studio this morning, I've got David Shepherd, who is, as I say, a real live broadcaster
on
BBC Southwest. And David's been telling us a little bit about his early life and his experiences in Oxford and how he came to have some connections with the great Terry Wogan. And from there then, David, you left Oxford and went to Bristol University eventually, didn't you?
Yes, Bristol. It really was a place that I knew well from early days. I had a great affection for Bristol. We used to go there a lot. And I think if I had my life again, I would have just gone there in the first place. And a very fine university. And the joke, of course, is that I came to leave Oxford and had to sort of find a way of telling parents that this had happened. And I decided it would be best if I made this decision while they were away on holiday. And it also then gave me a deadline by which I had to have something else lined up. So I emailed, because email had come in, replaced fax. Ooh, we're gradually getting through technology here. I emailed a lady at Bristol University called Julie, who was not the Chancellor. She was not the Vice Chancellor. She wasn't the head of department, but she was, in fact, a secretary in the English department. I said, well, I think I've made a terrible mistake here. I should have studied English first and I should have really come to Bristol. Is there any chance you could get me onto the course next year? Which sounds like a hopelessly difficult thing to do.
Possibly not the right way of going about it, or not conventional way of going about it.
And yet, she was very supportive, put me in touch with the right people, and only really through her willingness to help did I then find that I was onto a course that was even more oversubscribed than the one I was leaving.
Oh, right.
And so I was always very, very grateful to the people at Bristol who managed to get me through the right process in the end. But
course did you end up doing at Bristol?
Well, this is how I explained it to my parents. I said, well, engineering didn't go too well, so I've gone to the next one on the list, and I'm now doing English.
Right.
Which alphabetically follows on beautifully.
Did they buy that rather flimsy
excuse? There was some truth in it, but English became a favourite at school because of the wonderful Jane Schnepp, who was my English teacher for many years. And I wrote to her after I made the move from Oxford, and she said, "You've done the right thing."
Okay. So I felt instantly. And we've already touched upon your early radio interests and the Terry Wogan connection, but there's also something called Burst Radio crept in here. Was that at Oxford or at Bristol?
Well, this was the student radio station in Bristol, okay. And this was another good reason to leave and go to Bristol, because at that stage the Oxford student radio station had ceased to exist.
Oh, okay.
So there wasn't the opportunity there to get a bit of practice in. But when I went to Bristol, there was a fledgling station there called Burst FM, and we built it up over a period of years from broadcasting from an old toilet cubicle, okay, in the Students' Union building. And yes, the pan was still there, and it did still flush, and every show thought they were the first to test it. But of course, we all knew the show before had done that. And this was where I had my first chance to do a solo show, pressing the buttons as well as doing the speaking and learning about sounds and the techniques and how to make things work on the radio, what did work, what didn't work. And it was a wonderful opportunity to cut my teeth.
And that presumably just went out to the university community, did it?
Well, it was available for them. Whether anybody listened was another thing.
Okay, so that was your first exposure to radio. So you left Bristol in what year would that be? The early part of the 2000s, presumably.
It was 2004.
Yeah, okay.
And I left in a marked manner after I graduated. All my furniture from my student flat was piled into my dad's vintage coach,
ooh,
which I'll tell you more about later.
We might come on to that.
Yes,
it's just
yes.
possible, isn't it? Okay, so at that point, you then needed a job, presumably.
Yes, I'd already been hanging around the doors to Radio Bristol, which was the BBC station nearby, and asking if I could answer their telephones. And likewise, during the holidays, I've been doing a little bit of that at Radio Berkshire. And in fact, my first BBC shift, if you like, and I hate it when people describe radio work as shifts, because it's not a shift.
It's an art form, David.
There's no hard labour involved. It's turning up, having a good time, being professional and making sure that things go well. But ultimately, it's no great toil.
No, right.
But my first shift in BBC parlance was on Christmas Day 2002. And I was asked if I would go in and answer the phones on Christmas Day. And this was something like 6 o'clock in the morning till 6 o'clock at night, which sounds terrible with hindsight, but at the time I thought I'd hit the jackpot.
Yes, it was just what you wanted.
Yes.
Okay, so how did that translate into a job with the BBC then?
Well, I then had two offers at the point that I graduated, one from Radio Berkshire, which would take me back home to where I'd grown up, or one from Radio Bristol, where I did want to stay, because Bristol held a great part of my heart at that point and still does. But the Berkshire offer was slightly better. I would be doing more on-air work. And so it was a bit of a wrench, but I upsticked and moved back home, which after university is quite difficult because you go back a different person,
of course,
in many senses, and the boundaries are all slightly different. But for a brief period, moved back home and worked for Radio Berkshire, where I then started to cover shows as well as producing them. I got to work with all sorts of names who lived locally, because the thing about working in the home counties is that you get a lot of the London talent creeping across to do a bit of cover work every now and again. So all sorts of people. The late Paul Daniels was the first person
okay.
I worked with there.
Right.
And subsequently his wife, Debbie McGee,
yeah.
Who I had the job of being her very first producer on her first ever radio show.
Yeah.
And we had a really nice time working together.
Yeah. So you were doing quite a bit of on-air work then at Berkshire, were you?
Increasingly, I started to move away from the phone answering, and I'd be put on air to cover blocks of shows. And eventually I asked if I could do something which I thought was way out of my comfort zone, which was to present one of the late night shows, which went out on multiple radio stations at once, a bit like the one I'm doing at the moment. Yeah. For the South region, which I think was six radio stations all at once. And to my delight and yet horror, they said, yes, the next time Paul, who did it then, is on holiday, yes, we'll get you in, no problem. And you suddenly realise that if you ask, sometimes you do get. So you've got to be careful what you ask for.
Careful what you wish for.
But from that, I then got a lot of other cover work at radio stations around the home counties. And very often I'd find myself waking up in Reading and driving to somewhere like Oxford to do an early show on BBC Oxford, as it was then, and then driving back home, having a kip in the afternoon, and then popping into Radio Berkshire to do drive time.
Okay.
And at one stage in my life, it lasted for about a month while I was doing some maternity cover, I was waking up at 3:30 in the morning, doing a radio show in Oxford, coming home, having a kip, waking up at 3:30 in the afternoon. So the alarm was always going off at the same time. And the only way in my disorientated waking state I could determine whether it was morning or afternoon was whether or not I was wearing my socks. And I also had the cleanest teeth of all the people I knew because I was forever scrubbing them before or after bed. So they had twice as many cleans as the average tooth.
Okay, so look at my team of researchers have come up with the fact you worked at Berkshire, Oxford, Solent and Bristol. Is that roughly right?
All in quick succession, often at the same time.
And this was doing, if you like, cover work then for absent presenters mainly?
Yeah, mainly, yeah. I also had a Sunday morning show, which eventually led to, I think I was doing early Saturday, early Sunday, and the Sunday was on tape, the Sunday morning. And then I was doing a sort of Sunday lunchtime show, which was live as well.
Okay. All right. So it did begin to develop into your own programme.
A regular gig.
Yeah, I see. So that then eventually translated into where you've been longest, which initially was BBC Radio Devon, wasn't it?
Yes, that's right. I moved to Devon, which was another long-held ambition. Initially for a six-month contract, and it was presenting the weekend late show, which is, I suppose, the weekend equivalent of the show I'm doing now. And that was going to be for 6 months, and then I'd top up the work around the week by doing a little bit of production in the week and making some of the jingles and the trails and the promotions that you hear going out. Because we don't have adverts on the BBC.
Really?
Except for ourselves. We like playing a lot of adverts for ourselves. And so this was going to last for 6 months. And 7 years later, I don't think they've noticed that the contract is up.
You're still there.
But I'm still on direct debit, so I don't mind. I'll stay for as long as they'll have me.
Okay, look, we're going to have another track in a minute. And then let's come back and talk about your sort of current life at the BBC and what that comprises. But this is something, I must admit, I'd never heard of this before. This is The Cloud Suite by David Gates. And what's the significance of this?
Well, I like music that sounds nice. And that feels a bit glib to say that. But this has all sorts of different textures in it. And they all come together to form one great big whole. And David Gates's voice is just charming and so smooth. And of course, this is a really, really long song, and we all know why people on the radio like long songs.
It gives you the opportunity to do lots of other things in between time, doesn't
and
it?
And sometimes you have to. When you've got to go, you've got to go.
Right, let's have a listen then. The Cloud Suite by David Gates, or a bit of it, because don't go too far away, we're going to fade towards the end.
Adrift so far below. changing as they come and go. Makes me wonder why I'm up so high when really I am down so low. Of all the wonders I was one allowed, I think that I would always choose a cloud. Brings my feelings right out loud, whether I'm ashamed or proud. And on this airplane coming home to you, sometimes I think I've flown my whole life through, my whole as I wing my way to you.
Well, it seems a shame to fade that, the Cloud Suite by David Gates from 1973 from the album First, but it is nearly 9 minutes worth of track, and we've got a lot more conversation to go. David Shepherd is in the studio, and we've got as far as, David, the fact that you went to BBC Radio Devon, you were doing odd jobs there, and you eventually ended up having programmes of your own, but your main involvement there was with your afternoon programme, wasn't it?
Yes.
And how did that come about?
Well, I had initially been doing a drive time show, which was double-headed. And by double-headed, we mean that there was a male presenter and a female presenter. And the co-host I was working with, Joe Loosemore, a wonderful, wonderful friend, we got on tremendously. And the joke about double acts on the radio is that they sound like they're getting on the radio, and they hate each other off air. But that wasn't the case with us.
Right.
And apparently we were the only double act in radio who did like each other off the air. And we did that for a couple of years, and then Joe moved on to other things, and the show was given to me for the first 2 hours. It was a four-hour show, which I felt was a bit much to do solo. So I then had a two-hour show in the afternoon on Radio Devon. And we developed this sense with the afternoon show that actually it was a bit more relaxed than the programming earlier in the day. And what did people want? They wanted a bit of music, and they wanted a few local references, and they wanted to send us messages and have a laugh. And
yes,
that's what we did with it, really. And people would often say, well, this is as close to Wake Up to Wogan as you can get without Wogan, which I felt was the ultimate compliment.
That would be the ultimate compliment, yeah.
And we ambled on with that for, I think, about 3 years. And then the opportunity came up to do this late night show, which I do now, which was over a much wider area. So you had the four radio stations rather than just the one. And it was also at a time of day when the audience was very high for BBC local radio, because the audience profile tends to be 50 plus, and it tends to be people that have elected to listen to the radio as the main thing that they're doing in the evening. So they'll switch the television off, they'll switch the radio on, and they'll actually listen.
Yeah.
So you're not just on in a workshop or a kitchen as background. You tend to be a primary focus. So they're very loyal. And that really appealed to me, the idea of speaking.
So you took on the late evening programme, which, as we said, covers the whole of the southwest, really, Devon and Cornwall and the Channel Islands. And tell me about a typical day then. I mean, I'm sure people are intrigued. What time do you have to arrive for a 10 o'clock start?
Well, it's a very topsy-turvy lifestyle. I tend to get there for about 5 o'clock, and I'll drink a lot of coffee. I'll write a lot of ideas down. I don't work from scripts very well, but I do like to have notes. And I find that your mind is never off air, really. The kind of broadcasting that I like is stuff that reflects everyday life. I suppose we're going back to going back to comp school now and the mix of people. And I love everyday life, and I see a lot of fun in everyday life. And so you'll be walking around the supermarket and somebody will knock something over and you think, ah, there's a gem of an idea. I'll write it down. And so I arrive with these reams and reams and reams of notes, and occasionally I'll then just flesh them out a little bit, never scripted. I'll set up the music that I'm going to play. The BBC generally chooses the core of the music that is played on the show. And they think they choose it all, but occasionally one or two.
So you do have some say in that, do you?
Yeah, we have music features which tend to be chosen locally. And I've got a great friend called Phil Vowles, who's a continuity announcer for the BBC, and he helps me enormously with choosing music for these features. He's got an encyclopedic knowledge of the kinds of songs that work really, really well for the audiences that we're broadcasting to. Right. And he's a great help in selecting music for the features. And so I'll turn up. I eat my dinner out of Tupperware every night, and that's just one of the downsides of late night broadcasting, is that you never get a meal from a plate. It's always something you cooked earlier.
and tell me about the studios from which you broadcast. I mean, people won't know what we're sat in today, but we have quite a small studio here at Abbey 104, which you would imagine, because we're much smaller than the BBC. But have you got a big plush suite of studios? Do you choose which one to go into? And what's it like?
Well, we haven't always had a big plush suite of studios. We did have some of the oldest studios. I broadcast from the ones in Plymouth. We did have some of the oldest studios in the BBC, but in the last 2 years, we've been completely refurbished as part of a project to try and get some of the radio stations up and running with new digital kit, which will help them to sustain themselves in the future. And so actually what we have now, it looks very, very plush. And we have two studios side by side. I tend to use Studio One. They're a mirror image of one another, and technically they're both the same. Mm-hmm. But there's an odd thing when you're broadcasting, familiarity is everything.
Oh, yes.
And if you've ever driven a hire car, you'll know the havoc that having the indicators on the wrong side can wreak.
Yeah,
and it's exactly the same in radio. If you're used to going for the button on the right and suddenly it's on the left, much better to be in familiar surroundings.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I'll then amble on to air at 10 o'clock with everything prepared, everything scripted, everything prepared, and a vague idea of where things are going to go. And the beauty of that slot and the audience and the loyalty of the audience and the creativity of the audience is that you might set out to do a show about cats and you end up doing a story about things I heard on the top of the bus.
Okay.
And they take it in the direction that they want it to go.
So you rely very much on feedback from the audience, even quite late at night, and you do get quite a bit of that.
Yes, sometimes we get over 100 contributions per show, which you might think, well, we've got an audience of 250,000. It's a very small yield, but actually it's about quality. And we have some superb contributors who will write emails and witticisms even when the show isn't on air. I think that's a wonderful thing, to come in and find that somebody has been thinking about the show at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, 8 hours before it's even going to happen. And that is the ultimate compliment, when you get something that's really well written and you're able to go on and feed it back to people and give them an audience. I think that's a tremendous thing. Privilege.
And how many people are with you sat there? I mean, again, assuming that there's a team of people who are just looking after your every need, is that the case or not?
The wonder of radio is that very often what sounds big on the air is very small in the production. And for my show, it's just me and my 157-year-old assistant, Doris.
Ah, Doris, yes, of course. You refer to her quite a lot.
Well, she lives in the basement of Broadcasting House, and she's been there since Lord Reith came up with the idea for the corporation. She's one of the original employees. And actually, she was of pensionable age even when that happened.
Right.
So she's done remarkably to cling on, particularly given her deficiencies, because she's not very good at anything she does. I mean, the scripts she brings through
I'm sure there's a whole interview to be done on Doris, but unless you've heard the programme, then maybe we should park that one for now.
I'll slam the trapdoor on
Doris.
Yeah,
okay, all right. Look, we're going to take your penultimate track, and then we're going to focus on a few other strange interests that you've got, David.
Those.
What's this one coming up?
Well, this is one of my all-time favourites. This is the great Clifford T. Ward.
Okay, and the best is yet to come.
All the magic to put us on our way, and all the tragedy that we ever want to see. But you know I'm right when I say the best is yet to come. Where did we go wrong? Was it so enlightening we couldn't find our way? Was it all so frightening we really couldn't see which move to make? But you know I'm right when I say the best is yet to come. And if you leave me now, like you say you might, oh please don't leave me now, 'cause I know if you do, none of this will come true. So where do we go now? Now your heart is aching and leading you, and me, I'm burning up trying to get you to stay. 'Cause you know I'm right when I say the best is yet to come. And you know the best is still to come.
The best is yet to come from Clifford T. Ward, 1981, subsequently released on a 1984 album, Both of Us, covered by a lot of people, including Charles Aznavour.
I didn't know that.
Well, there you
go. Didn't know that.
We're here to inform.
It's a wonderful song, and I like to think that I'm an optimist. I strive to be an optimist, and I'm definitely partway there. And I know this because I read in a newspaper recently that optimists have one thing in common. They're always late.
Ah, well, you weren't late this morning.
It's the first time. First time ever.
Okay, David, look, we've talked about your current programme on BBC Radio Devon, and that's going incredibly well. And any ambitions? What's next?
Well, I'd really love to do a bit of national radio at some point. Yeah. I think the fashion really now is... I'd more easily get a gig, I think, on Radio 2 if I was on Big Brother. Than coming from a broadcasting background, and I think that's just the way things are at the moment. But nonetheless, I think if you stick at it for long enough, somebody will have you in the end. So we'll see how that
be
goes.
Persistent.
I'm quite happy with my corner of the universe. I rather love it down in the West Country, and it's a nice exclusive.
Because you're living in Exeter, aren't you?
That's right. Yeah. We don't let everybody in down there.
Certainly not. we could talk a lot more about BBC. The time is not with us, however, and there's one big area of your life that we haven't actually touched upon yet.
I shudder to think.
And this is the fact that this is crazy. I must have copied this down wrong. You actually own a couple of buses, is that right?
Yes, who would? This started as a young lad. I developed an obsession with On the Buses. And again, this was secondhand.
The TV programme.
Yes. It was secondhand because they were showing repeats of this on the television. And I found them funny. But moreover, I fell in love with the buses that were in On the Buses. And my dad and I used to go off around the country to all sorts of far-flung places where this type of bus, the Bristol Lodecker, used to work. And there were still a few of them lingering on when I was a child. And if you went in search, if you knew where to look, you'd you'd see them at rallies or at the Isle of Wight. They had a lot of them still running around there. So we'd be forever trying to find these. And suddenly we came up with this strange idea that if there were still a few around, why don't we buy one and restore it?
A real one.
A real one. Double-decker, this, 30-foot long, 14-foot high, just about. And I remember one time decorating my parents' bedroom. I was always helping out with things at home. And my dad said to me, this wallpaper here is really difficult to get off because they made it to stick back then. It doesn't anymore, but they made it to stick back then. He said, if we can strip the wallpaper by the end of the day, we'll buy a bus. And in fact, if we can strip it by lunchtime, it'll be a Bristol low-decker.
Okay.
So we went for it. We went for it. We didn't get it done that day, but we did buy the bus and we did buy the Bristol low-decker.
So this was during... You were quite young at this point.
I would have been seven
okay,
at this point.
Right.
And we bought this thing. It was a wreck of a bus. It did have an MOT, but it couldn't have possibly been anywhere near the test station
right.
because nothing worked on it. The wiring was horrendous. We didn't have anywhere to keep it because where do you keep a double-decker bus?
Yeah.
Fortunately, my dad had a friend who owned a farm and we kept it there in the mud for years and years. Well, not years and years, actually, just a couple of years while we did the first bit of renovation work to it. But I remember it as if it was a hugely long period where forever I was in welly boots up to my knees in mud, scraping paint off an old bus.
So you obviously had a bit of history here with your dad, but it came to a point then when you actually bought your own bus.
Yes. Well, and that's very difficult.
How did that come about?
I was offered a first refusal on a bus that I'd been very interested in for a number of years, and this was a coach that was based down in the West Country in Kingsbridge. And I had a photograph of this bus that I found when I was very, very young. And I initially at that stage didn't know it had survived, but it turned out that it had and it was going to become available. And would I like it?
Okay.
And you face a situation where it's never going to be a sensible thing to buy a bus.
Hardly.
And yet, so it could be so rewarding. And so I decided that I'd go for it. And there have been very few times when I've ever regretted it. I've been restoring it gradually over the past 7 years, and we've now got it to a stage where I can take it out a bit and have confidence that I might get home that night, often under its own power.
That is incredibly rewarding, isn't it?
When it goes well. There are other times, but
well, I can't imagine anybody being so foolish but to buy a bus.
Who else might? No.
Who else might? Indeed. But that's wonderful. And you have a lot of fun with this, I would imagine.
Yes. It's particularly during the summer months, it's a weekly thing to be taking it
but
out.
But a real labour of love.
Yes, yes. And I've got another one that I'm restoring at the moment, which I think is a much longer-term project.
Yeah. And mentioned just very briefly, because we're almost out of time, the Thames Valley Omnibus, what was it?
Thames Valley and Great Western Omnibus Trust, which is, it's a charity that we run, which restores the vehicles and then actually uses them and takes people out. So we do running days for most weekends in the summer where we'll take the buses out, we'll recreate a timetable in a given town. And we've just had a very successful event down in Penzance where we've given about 6,500 free rides to people.
Gosh.
And the whole town becomes effectively the 1960s all yes. over again.
It sounds wonderful.
I'm very proud to be a trustee there and trying to establish that a bit more.
Yeah. Look, David, it's coming up to 2 minutes to the hour. I'm not quite sure where that hour has gone, but we're going to play out with your last track, which I'm going to be completely honest and say I think this is probably one of the most irritating pieces of music ever recorded.
I think it's designed to be. This finishes my show every night at 1 o'clock, and the listeners hate it.
Yes, I can well understand why. Anyway, David Shepherd, it's been a real pleasure having you here. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you for having me, Terry.
All right, no problem. Bye for now.
Well, I know it goes... That's it, isn't it? You must remember
yes.
this, you've heard it before.
Oh, dear.
Go on, Norman. Shall I?
Yes, you've got an awfully nice voice.
Oh, silly.
Yeah, I mean it.
La la, la 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 la.
It's so grounded.
La la, la la. la 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 la.
Change of key.
What's that?
Different notes, silly.
Oh, la la la. I'm in. I got it. That's it. La 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 la. Don't need it.
Sorry.
Da da dee da. La 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 la. La 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 la
la la la
la la la la la la la la la
la la la la la
la la la la
la la la la la la la la
la la la la la la la
la
la la
la la.
From the Sky News Centre at midday, the Conservatives have accused Jeremy Corbyn of planning to pull apart the UK's defences if he becomes Prime Minister. The Work and Pensions Secretary, Damian Green, also claims the Labour leader would be soft on terrorism. He was responding as Mr Corbyn refused to say whether keeping the Trident nuclear deterrent would be in the Labour manifesto.
What he said this morning was that he would dismantle Britain's nuclear defences and he would fail to deal effectively with terrorism. This man could be Prime Minister in 7 weeks' time. I can't think of a better reason